Thanks for that story, Joyce. I think you told it better than Samuel. If I had your version in there, I would have done a lot better, I think, with this sermon. How would you explain Christianity to someone who had never heard of it before? How would you explain it in the simplest terms possible? Reduced to the bare essentials. Could you pick out, say, the top five beliefs? The top things that you have to believe or the top things that you have to do? Think about it just for a minute. When I teach Mennonite studies at GBC, I almost always start the year with these questions. I normally put students into groups and hold what I term a convert me challenge. I pretend that I've moved to Winkler from, I always use Bora Bora. I don't even know where Bora Bora is. Maybe they're Christians there. I don't know. I say, I moved to Winkler from Bora Bora. I know nothing whatsoever about Christianity, never heard of it, never seen a Bible, haven't heard the name Jesus. And I say that they have to prepare one of their group members to come sit down with me in front of the class and explain to me what people do in Winkler on Sunday morning. Most people. I don't care if they're Christian or not. I mean, I care, but that has nothing to do with this activity. I want them to be able to articulate what it is to be Christian or not to be Christian. So if they're not Christian, that's fine. Just tell me what that means, what you're not. The discussions are always really exciting and lively. It's hard to do to simplify things down to the bare essentials. Almost without a doubt, my students will at some point in the discussions argue that a Christian must believe in what the Bible teaches and do what it says. I think they go there because that seems to cover so many other things, right? You get the Bible in, and then you get a whole bunch of stuff with it. So they often go there, and I always ask in response, well, do I have to be able to read? No, you don't have to read. It's okay. You just have to believe what it says about God, and you have to do what it says too. Perfect. My next class starts with an old-fashioned Bible drill. We do it like this. I have Gideon Bibles, a whole class set, and they have to put, you know, have you done it? In youth group when you were a kid, maybe? You put the Bible up, and I read out a chapter and a verse. And then the first one to find it and stand up and start reading gets a point for their team. And again, not to be too old-fashioned, I say if they don't know the Bible well, they can use their iPhone. Oh, I left mine over there. They can use their iPhone. So it's either a Bible or an iPhone or whatever they have in the air. And then I read out the passage. And then I say, swords down. And they got to find the verse, stand up and start reading. Now, the verses I use for this competition are chosen pretty carefully. They're among the most bizarre passages found in the Old Testament. You probably know some of them. I always try to include Leviticus 21, verse 18 to 20, where Yahweh states that, quote, no one who is blind or lame or no one who has a flat nose, hunchback, an itching disease, or crushed testicles shall draw near to the Lord. That's always a hit. And then I try to throw in maybe 2 Kings 2, verse 23, where Elisha is teased by a group of boys for being bald. The boys say, go away, bald head, go away, bald head. And Elisha gets really mad and curses them in the name of God. And God sends out two bears. Two bears come out of the woods, and the bears maul 42 of the young boys. They tend to like that one. There are many, many, many more, and probably you know them, some of them too. If you don't, I mean, go to Google. You can search bizarre, but there are just so many bizarre passages. And almost as soon as we start this game, I mean, we're one or two verses in, and I start getting objections. They say, Mr. G, you're taking these verses out of context. Why are you doing this? And I say, yeah, of course I am. But aren't these verses bizarre nonetheless? And isn't this game fun? And they usually respond, yeah, they're bizarre, and yep, this is fun. And we keep going. And then, of course, the protests grow a bit louder, and they start to say, but everything changes with Jesus. Okay, the passage, I like Deuteronomy, where it says, you know, rebellious children, they take them out and stone them. They say, no, that's no good anymore. Jesus changes everything. We don't have to worry about that stuff. We're all good. They insist. This, of course, is part of my point. I want them to think about how the Bible isn't flat. That in our discussion the day before, when they say we have to believe and follow the Bible, that no, it's not quite that simple. There are parts of the Bible that are quite important and other parts that aren't so important. There are laws and instructions that apply to us, but also laws and instructions that don't apply to us. And add to this, and this might be a little more controversial, I would argue that there are also descriptions of God and his acts in the Bible that are Christian, and also descriptions of God and his acts in the Bible that aren't Christian. For Christians, and I think for Anabaptist Christians even more, Christ is the fullest revelation of God. His life and his teachings are the center, the climax of the Bible, the lens through which we must read all other parts of Scripture. The trump card, I used to say, but will not say any longer, for obvious reasons. In our context here at Covenant Mennonite Church, this is perhaps to state the obvious. We tend to be, as Tony Campolo puts it, red-letter Christians. We would way rather read the Beatitudes than 2 Samuel. At least I would. And yet here we are finishing up, 6 weeks of study of David? 6 weeks? It's been a while studying David. So why not let the Old Testament be? If Jesus changes everything, why do we need to read 2 Samuel? I read this passage, or this chapter, 2 Samuel 9, numerous times leading up to this Sunday. And if I'm being honest, I have to say, there wasn't a whole lot there for me. I appreciate the terms pulled out in the Sunday school story, and especially the way you told it. I think it brought out the theme of kindness really well. I can see it. I mean, I read this guy here, Eugene Peterson, and some of these commentaries, and I get it. It makes sense. I can see how they would say it's a story about generosity, about love, about David honoring his friendship with Jonathan by blessing his son Mephibosheth. David did, according to custom, have every right to kill off all of Saul's descendants so as to protect his throne. I can appreciate how some Old Testament commentators could interpret this as a story about trust in God, with David trusting that God will protect his position of power, even though Mephibosheth or his son Micah could someday threaten his kingdom. I get that. It makes sense. If it's told the right way, I think it's even moving. The problem is, when you read the other chapters around this one, if you read chapter 8 or chapter 10, oh my goodness. Chapter 8, for instance, as far as I can tell, marks one of the high points in David's kingship. Here are just a few of the highlights. You can go home and read it for yourself. Number 1, David attacks and subdues the Philistines. Number 2, David defeats the Moabites. He makes them lie down in a row. Duk, 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 duk. And then he takes a cord and he wants to kill just 2/3 of them and spare 1/3. So he measures, I think this is what's happening. He uses a cord. He measures out 2/3, kills those ones, leaves one, measures another 2, kills those ones. Number 3, David kills King Hadadezer. I don't know if that's how you say it, but that's what I'm going to say. Taking from him 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers, and then he cuts the hamstrings of all but 100 of these captured horses. Number 4, this is all in chapter 8. David kills 22,000 Arameans, 22,000 soldiers, 40,000 horsemen, and 700 chariot teams. And then he takes the rest of them, and they become his servants. And then number 5, David gathers up all the silver, gold, bronze, shields, swords, everything plundered from Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, etc., 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 and he brings it all and he dedicates it to God. And then the writer of Samuel states directly what he's already made obvious, not just in chapter 8, but also in chapter 10 and in the earlier chapters, that the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. As far as I can tell, this section of 2 Samuel can't be read with avoiding an obvious main point. David conquered the world because God was on his side. He was no doubt a great warrior king, perhaps the greatest ever, and why? The text is clear. Because God was on his side. God readied his sword for battle and steadied his shield. It was all God. This is the main point. To me, David's kindness to Mephibosheth, as I read the rest of this, it's more of a footnote. The main point is a king conquers if God is on his side and fails if God is not on his side. And David had God on his side. David does show kindness to Mephibosheth. That's clear. But we should also note that in the appendix to 2 Samuel, which is kind of the latter section, a bunch of random stories that try to fill the gaps of the earlier chapters, the author notes that while David did spare Mephibosheth, he had no problem handing all of Saul's other descendants over to the Gibeonites so that the Gibeonites could impale them on the top of their holy mountain. Some kind of religious ceremony there. If we want to be a little cynical, and perhaps I'm too cynical already, we might suggest that keeping Mephibosheth alive was a fairly low-risk way to ease his conscience, to help him sleep easy, to honor his commitment to Jonathan, while knowing that Mephibosheth, as a cripple, was really no threat. Surely no one in the ancient world would follow or rally behind a cripple over a great warrior king like David. For me, if I read the story of Mephibosheth in the context of these other chapters, the power of his kindness to Mephibosheth is kind of lost. If I can pull it out and tell it as a kid's story, it's there for me. If I read it in the whole of the book, it's not there for me. The military drama is center stage. King wins if God's on his side. King loses if God's not on his side. So why bother with this story then? Why not stick with the red letters? With the Beatitudes? Let's get over to Christmas already. Well, I actually did, even though I've been a little cynical here, I did find reading these stories valuable on one main account. Next Sunday, we'll put David behind us and start the season of Advent. And yet, the season of Advent starts with David. The city of David. The Christ child will be born in the city of David, in the line of David. This baby is to be the Messiah, the new David, the new King of the Jews, A king whose rule will not end. There will be no Bathsheba in this story. No great decline into sin, corruption, defeat. The story that shapes us is one where the radical nature of this new King David comes clear, perhaps clearest, when it's set against the story of this old King David. As for the old King David, I think we must see him as he is. He's a warrior king, one who slaughtered thousands in the name of the Lord, who conquered nation after nation, who became rich through the plunders of war, who dedicated gold, silver, and bronze to his God, who cut the hamstrings of horses, and one who destroyed all the descendants of Saul save a cripple. Many Jews at the time of Christ longed for another such warrior king, someone to rival the power of Rome, a Messiah who would restore the kingdom of David and rebuild the temple, a military hero with God on his side. How disappointing, then, to find in the city of David a baby in a stable, a man who rides a donkey, a servant who washes the feet of lesser men, who defends women, who spends time with lepers, and perhaps most importantly, a man who chooses to suffer instead of to fight. How disappointing to find in Advent an entirely different picture of God and his acts. To me, the contrast between the old David and the new David makes the message of Advent clear. And it's for that reason that I've enjoyed rereading the story of David, the great warrior king of the Jews.